The more we taste the silence, the more we start meeting the world in silence. Otherwise, we are too consumed by our story. This is happening to me. This is my life situation. This is the burden I'm carrying. This is the cross I'm carrying. Me, me, me. So we are normally meeting the world with the mind not at peace. Situation may not be peaceful. There might be a situation which is challenging. But to meet that challenging situation in silence or in turbulence, that is something which we have to look at. Now, the last talk we had with Seema was how you feel the vastness. It reminded me, a memory came up. I don't know if I was 18, 19, 20, something like that. And I was in the plane and landing in Mumbai at night. And so from the window, I saw millions upon millions of lights, street lights, house lights, just these bright millions upon millions of lights. And I remember it struck me that each house I can see from up here has people living in it, and each person so tiny. Up from that height, a tiny thing is consumed by their life. So many stories, life stories, and I'm looking at them from above. And then the next thought was, if one body-mind organism in all these millions I'm seeing from above dies, what difference does it make? For me, who am viewing this from above, yes, for that household, pain, suffering, no doubt. But that same thought came to me that if I am the vastness, I can see it all from above, I'm the witness of it all, then does my problem in the larger scheme of things matter that much? Or a total acceptance of the situation without fighting it? And using my intellect to the best of my ability to deal with it. That is all. And so each situation, each challenge, each life circumstance started getting met in that vastness, that awareness. That awareness, which from that height in the plane could see this manifest world below and the millions of lights. Is right here, right now. And that is very auspicious. Auspicious consciousness, it is called. The other word for it is God, the source, totality, auspicious consciousness. In that auspicious consciousness, we meet people who love us as well as people who trouble us, the polaric opposites. But that auspicious consciousness, that awareness does not judge. It is just pure awareness. Just like the sun does not judge whom will I shine my rays on and whom I will not shine my rays on. But the individual, the me, with its likes, dislikes, preferences, that is the troublemaker. So when we start seeing through life, through people, through situations, this quality of witnessing, resting in that auspicious consciousness, starts shining more and more. When that starts happening, that is the living meditation. Earlier, I'm consumed by the living dream of life. Now, life is a living meditation. There will still be pain, there will still be pleasure. But everything is seen as transient, moving. And more importantly, in that auspicious consciousness, I have no enemies. It may appear that I have. But when I see that everyone in my life is playing their script, their role assigned to them by one power, their blueprint, just like I am no longer trying to pull down someone. Training my guns on someone, hating someone for what they've done to me, or condemning them, or criticizing them. Who am I to criticize? one instrument criticizing another instrument through whom consciousness functions. So when that dialogue goes, now I must focus not on the individual but on my problem. So I'm fully available now to meet the situation, perhaps caused by this individual. But because my focus is not on the other as someone to hate, my focus is now the situation I am in. So a sense of objectivity comes in. Earlier I would react, now I respond. That is the difference. Subtle difference, but major difference. Everything then becomes a learning. Every challenge I face, every loss I face, I realize there's something to learn from it. Yes, I might question God if a challenge is going on too long, or loss upon loss upon loss of one kind or the other, that how much do you want me to learn? For that, He knows. That is why my teacher would say, a painting can never know why its painter painted it. So the why questions drop away. That why me? What have I done wrong? That dialogue goes. I mentioned it earlier when someone asked my teacher, who was suffering a lot in life, why me? After giving her whole life story, she said, why me? And at that time, I was also young and impressionable, and I found his answer was quite harsh. But later I realized whatever comes out from the sage's words has a reason. So when she said, why me, after listing all her challenges, he replied, why not? Because we are entitled beings. So we start questioning when these things happen. And then the mind loves that story. There's a phrase for it, the joy of suffering. Why do we love to suffer? Because now I know who I am. I have an identity. Ego is very mischievous. Loves to suffer and loves to make others suffer. So now it has company, a company of suffering.
It's an indulgence.
It is a super indulgence. And it is called living unconsciously till my last breath. And if I'm aware of this, living unconsciously till my last breath, and the option is presented by the source to live consciously, then the game is over. Then each breath is your last breath. It does not mean being passive about life. It does not mean meeting challenges. But removing the sense of doership, just like Krishna told Arjuna, you still have to fight your battle. You putting your bow and arrow down is doership, because your nature is to fight, your genetics is to fight, your conditioning is to fight. That is your very nature. So he did not tell Arjuna, no, please be passive, don't fight. If you have an opponent in front of you, depending on your nature, someone's nature may not be to fight. By all means, don't fight. Someone's nature may be to fight. So he was just pointing this out. You have a situation, neither are they the doers nor are you. And since your conditioning, your genetics, your nature is to fight, pick up that bow and fight, because you are not killing them. I, as time, have already killed them. Now, when we can live this understanding that everyone in our life who appears against us is acting according to their nature, just as I am, the burden of doership is removed. Yet, if my nature is to fight, fight I must. But I am no longer fighting an individual. And more importantly, I now know I cannot guarantee the results. Results may or may not be what I want. In school, you study hard for a subject and you're disappointed by the marks. You can't guarantee the results. Or the opposite happened. You don't study enough and you do very well in a subject. This is everyone's life experience. Thy will be done. This to me is open-eyed meditation, daily living. Would anyone like to share anything regarding the meditation or their experience or ask something?
Namaste Guruji, thank you for giving me the opportunity.
So in the last meeting when I met you, you told me to focus. I had a question on self-inquiry, so I asked you that time. So you told me to focus on who is looking at the blankness which is in front of eyes. So I got to that point and I understood that it is something different which is watching the blankness. So from that point, I am stuck at two points. One thing is this beam, it is like a camera which is the lens opens outside, and outside is the world which includes thoughts, like mind, we can say. So this is one problem where it this because the functioning, the lens is outside, it opens outside, it doesn't let the focus go inside. This is one thing. And another thing is, it is like if the mind sees the red color, the mind is totally like mesmerized by that red color. It forgets itself that it is watching the red color. So I'm stuck at these two points. So if you can elaborate.
Why do you say you're stuck? Why do you say you are stuck at these two points? The lens of the camera is opening to the external. So where are you stuck? The knowledge is there that the lens of the camera is opening to the external. Most of us don't have that awareness. Can you live your life as the void?
I'm not getting you.
You have the awareness that the lens of the camera opens to the outside world. When my eyes are closed and they open to the outside world. Why do we close our eyes in meditation? To stop the engagement with the outside world. So the consciousness rests within. You already know that. The eyes must open to function in daily living. The lens of the camera must open to function in daily living. So why are you calling that being stuck? Where is the problem with that?
Because as soon as the eyes are open, it forgets itself and it goes like haywire outside.
The mind goes haywire. The thinking mind, which gets engaged in daily living, goes haywire. The working mind, if you are a surgeon and you're performing a surgery and you have 25 years experience behind you, your working mind will be fully engaged or will your mind go haywire? Fully engaged, right? So who is going haywire? It is only the thinking mind which can go haywire. A mind which is established in being and in the self, when it engages with the world, it doesn't feel it is going haywire. It realizes this is the nature of life and living. So it does not qualify that as going haywire. Maybe the preference is the silence of the void, which has been touched, no doubt. But because we are in manifest form in the body, we have to engage with the world. We have to honor that. So a sage like Ramana Maharshi, used to go into the kitchen early in the morning to chop the vegetables. His mind was not going haywire. But yet, in this life, he had a preference to go into the ashram kitchen to prepare everything for the meal. So if you are able to deal with life, daily living, just engaging with it doesn't mean the mind is going haywire. The mind is going haywire if I lose my peace. So the question to ask yourself is, am I losing my peace in life or not? If I'm not, and by I find that I'm peaceful, it is not going haywire. It may appear that this absolute self, quietness, stillness is so beautiful that even this engagement is too much, but there is no choice. That is a different matter. So let's say I have tasted the void, the absolute nothing, pure being, and I come back. Daily living seems to be like a chore. Could be. But I will not lose my peace in that daily living. The preference may be to go back and be there all the time. Why not? But then in daily living, when action is called for, action happens. When no action is called for, witnessing happens. And when there's nothing to witness, non-witnessing happens. No complaint. It is rare to find a sage who complains.
Guruji, at what point do we stop? For example, like if we take the example of deep sleep and in the waking state, so when I close the eyes in the waking state, able to see that there is a difference, but in deep sleep there is nothing. So I'm not able to understand that whatever things we speak of, like whatever things the gurus speak of, so it is exactly what, at what point do we stop?
It is all irrelevant in deep sleep, because you are not there as an individual in deep sleep. So whether it is a guru who's talking in the waking state, a friend, a relative, or a stranger on the road, they all get annihilated as such. The only difference between the guru speaking in the waking state versus everyone else is that the source chooses one instrument amongst many to represent itself, and that instrument is still part of the dream. But that instrument's task, so to speak, assigned by the source, not by the instrument, is to wake you up from the living dream of life. And when that happens, all instruments vanish, because the dream is over. The dream of separation is over. When you are at peace, so simple. When your mind is no longer agitated in the waking state, no longer full of condemnation, hatred, malice, jealousy, envy, pride, arrogance, guilt, shame, you know you arrived. So simple. When you find that things don't disturb you like they used to earlier, you have arrived. That is why Ramana Maharshi said the state of equanimity is the state of bliss. The state of equanimity, which is basically the pendulum of your life, is still at the center point, not swinging wildly to the left, not wildly to the right. Like the ordinary person is just swinging between pleasure and pain, trying to run away from pain, try to chase pleasure, and lives their life out like that. But when you realize this is an endless game, and you start finding that your pendulum is still, challenges come, you're not disturbed that much. Pleasures come, you're not enticed that much. And you realize for yourself that I am no longer suffering psychologically. Then I know I have arrived in these very simple ways. Now, for example, it's not really a relevant example to give, but it's come up because a situation was brought to my attention recently. There is someone who has been on a spiritual journey for 65 years. They are in their late 80s now. 65 years. And I met this person and came across as someone really like a kindred soul. But then by and by, people had to deal with this person. And I found out that he was rude, he was obnoxious, and was speaking ill about others. Now, to me, that is a mind not at peace. So we know for ourselves, are we at peace? Nothing troubles us like it used to. For example, you invest in the stock market. There's a crash. Now, either you can wallow in self-pity, blaming yourself for making the wrong moves, and so on and so forth, and your peace is destroyed. Or you have the understanding, I tried my best. I thought it would work out for me. Based on that, I took a decision. But God's will was something else. So in the second instance, when there is no hatred for myself and no blame to myself, I'm more at peace than the other person. But the situation is still there. Pain will still be there. It's pain to lose money. Now, using this knowledge, this lesson life has taught me, I have to go ahead. I have to decide how much more risk I can take in future, how much I should not. That is the learning of life. Now, two things can happen. Either I repeat my mistakes, or I'm wiser by the first round. We don't know. So someone goes along through the ups and downs with a peaceful nature, anchored in peace, experiencing pleasure and pain as they arise, but not carried away, whereas the other person gets carried away and therefore is suffering. That is why Maharaj said that between the banks of pleasure and pain, the river of life flows. But the problem is, we like to be only on one side of the bank. That is the problem. So what all you have described also in the past, I feel you have for yourself experienced that state, but only its integration into daily living has to happen. And this is how it happens. Very simply put, like my teacher would say, you start driving a car, then you have to appear for driving test and you are given the license. But that does not mean you can drive from Andheri to Churchgate in Sukha Shanti. You're going to be nervous. It's a long drive. There are buses, there are trucks, a lot of cars. But you've just learned to drive, you see. But you come here for 5 years. Now, let's say 5 years of driving is behind you and you find, my God, 5 years ago when I was given the license, it was really stressful driving from Andheri to Churchgate. Now it's a breeze. Then you know that your learning, your lessons are now integrated within you, and so you're no longer stressed by the drive. This in Zen is called deliverance. So there's awakening, which is getting the license. You know something now which you didn't know before. You know how to drive. You didn't know that before. But that is just the license. And deliverance is what? Awakening, functioning in daily living is deliverance. And how do I know I have been delivered? By peace of mind. That is why Goldsmith would repeat Jesus' words, "Thou will keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on thee." Perfect peace. He didn't say perfect experience of bliss or whatever. "Thou will keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on thee" means what? Whose mind is stayed on God, consciousness, the source, totality, not on individuals doing things. Now, individuals are part of that source. Nothing is apart from God. But because my mind is no longer focused on individuals doing things, it is focused on God. That is how I live my life. The rivers of karma run deep. We don't know why people do the things they do to us in this life. We don't know the full story. Our view is very limited. But based on that limited view, we judge. That is the problem. Someone sent me a nice graffiti. "People are very judgmental. I can just say by looking at them." Amazing. That is the Maya. Yes, you were going to ask something?
So you mentioned...
What is your name?
Tanisha.
Tanisha.
Tanisha. You've been here before. What do you do?
I'm a master's student. So I was actually thinking about this question even before, and today you mentioned it as well with the Krishna and Arjuna thing. And I'm not sure I fully understand the difference between passivity and acceptance, or your nature and your duty. Because why was it Arjuna's duty to fight, and how do we know it was his nature? If he didn't want to in that moment, why? It was a destructive thing to do, so why was he not allowed to go ahead with it? And if he completely accepted the situation, how was it not a... I don't understand what it means to be passive if you're not accepting it. I'm a little confused about what...
Okay, let's take it to our daily living first. I know some people, as everyone would in their lives, who have the energy of 5 people. I know people who can do 5 things at the same time. I can't. Now, that person doing 5 things at the same time is acting according to their nature. They have been given that energy. I have not been given that energy. I can only do 1 thing at a time. So we are both acting according to our nature. If the person doing five things at the same time says, oh, I'm doing too much, I should not, and starts getting caught in this web, trying to be other than what God has gifted them skill sets with, that is the mind which has come in based on doership. Because it thinks I am doing too much. It doesn't realize I'm an instrument through whom this is happening, because I've been given that nature. The person who can only do one thing at a time tries to do five things and fails. It gets distracted because I must do this, I must do that, I must be like that person. But you're not that person. So this is individual nature and acting according to one's nature. It is not about passivity, and this teaching is not saying be passive. This teaching is saying act according to your nature. Now, Arjuna's nature was clearly that of a warrior, but he felt he is in charge, he is in control, and I have decided I'm not going to do this. And he has taken Krishna as his guru. Instead of taking others, he said, I'll take only Krishna in the battlefield. Krishna was his higher self. So his higher self is telling him, just recalibrate what's going on here. Relook at it. You suddenly thought you are the doer. And then the moment of realization is Arjuna's, not Krishna's. So what part is confusing you in this?
Okay, let me bring it back to me.
Yes, that would be better. And a situation perhaps you are facing in life. Yeah.
So, during work, what happens sometimes is I have a little bit of a difficulty understanding, is it my duty to do this? And if I don't want to do this, is it okay for me to not want to do this? At what point do I say, at what point do I disagree and say this is not for me? And at what point does it become my duty?
Very simple. As long as you are willing to accept the consequences of your actions, you have to decide. Living according to one's dharma is that. I have to decide, but the point is my decision will have consequences. So am I okay with what happens based on what I decide? So simple. Now, for example, I met someone in Pune, young 24, 25 year old, doing very well at work. Now he feels, I've had enough of this job. So his question was, what do I do? I said, start applying for other jobs if you feel that your learning is over here. But he was itching to leave his job. So I told him that it would be prudent, since you're so young, 24, 25 is young, that get another job in hand before leaving this job. Now if that itch is so strong, then be prepared for the consequences, which means you will leave this job and you may not get the other job in time. Who knows? So he has to decide. Nobody else can decide for him. He has to decide, am I really fed up in this job, or am I able to manage it? Meanwhile, I start applying elsewhere. So just to be mindful that actions have consequences. Otherwise, you'll say, oh, how foolish of me. I left this job thinking I'll be hired immediately, but I wasn't. So one is a reaction-based situation where I've reacted to this job without giving it much thought, and I find I've landed in a soup by resigning. Or two is, I have a situation, I'm aware I'm unsatisfied, but I'm mindful, and I do things, start looking out, whatever, and then take the step. None of it is in my control. The only difference is the awareness that actions have consequences which I may or may not like. That is the only difference. Otherwise, I could live my whole life taking irrational decisions based on feelings and emotions and suffering that all my life. Because usually we are in the reaction mode. We don't give things much thought. We react. React. We react all the time. And life goes by that way. And then regrets and disappointments. Oh, I should not have reacted that way. I was too quick to do that. I was too quick to say that. So the wise one is able to take a step back look at things, look at the situation, understand there are consequences to be faced, and that way they live their life. If there is a particular situation, we can discuss that.
I'm a linguist, and the more I go ahead in academia, the more confused I get about what we're doing. When we started it, I was very curious and the learning part was interesting. But the more we get into the details, everything feels very pedantic and circular. And I started it, so I want to see it through. But at the same time, I find myself losing more and more motivation. I would like to do something that is grounded in more heart or something of that sort. So midway, I realized that maybe this is not my calling, such an intellectual path. Mm-hmm. So I was just a little confused about, do I see this through, or do I say enough is enough? But what you said makes sense about the consequences and just having to make a choice and then deal with whatever it brings.
And not only that, it could be that I realize this is work. This is the work dimension. I didn't think it would be what it turned out to be, but so be it. And this, the rest of it is my spiritual exploration. So now some people are very dependent on their work. It's too risky for them to leave their jobs. A certain amount is coming every month. They have to decide, can I afford that risk or not? And they say, all right, I can't take that risk now. So although it's not turned out to be what I thought it was, I can still deal with it. I'd prefer it than not having a job. Or I decide it's time to move. But this inquiry, this heart-based thing, can be another aspect, because this could be just need-based right now. Not everyone loves their jobs. It's very rare to love your job and do well in it. Those people are very blessed. That is really the biggest blessing, to love your job and do well in it. But those who don't love their job but are getting income, it's a luxury to complain, because what about those who would do anything for your job who are not getting a job? So everything is so relative. It's all relative. Someone may do anything for your job. That is why I was reading this book by a Russian, I don't know what you call him. He's like not only a scientist, but a healer, come this, that, 100 things. He said there's a big problem with childhood toys. He said the parent who is spoiling their child with toy after toy after toy, setting the child up for disaster. Because that one toy done, next toy done, is going to go on into adulthood. When there's no spiritual aspiration given to a child, this is the risk. And I fully resonate with it. Then you will take 10 jobs and be unhappy, because these are toys. We get bored. Lose interest till the next pleasure comes along. The next toy, wow. Then that goes. And then you go. That is how you live life. I thought about it. I keep referencing a friend of mine who's now well into his 60s, who just buys material toys, whether it's cars, watches, whatever, or holidays, anything. And loves it till he buys the next car. Loves it till he buys the next watch. And once we were having lunch, I wanted to tell him, do you realize even you will go? But I thought it would not be appropriate.
Osho says, what else is in this world but toys?
True. That is what this inquiry is about. That is what this vastness is about.
A thought arose now that, you know, we all have egos, some to a lesser extent and some to a much bigger extent. And one realizes in a situation, you know, that ego is working up within me, and the working mind tries to stop it. But this thinking mind doesn't, you know, let it go. I want to know, how can we bring it back to that pendulum, as you said, or, you know, to a state where you let go of that ego? The thinking mind should let go of the ego, knowing there's an ego within, but unable to let go of.
See, the ego is the thinking mind. The ego is the thinking mind. The one who is asking this question is the one who's causing the trouble. Therefore, how to end this? What is the force which cuts off this thinking mind? The ego is the thinking mind. It won't cut itself out because it derives its sense of self from thinking. That force which cuts it is grace. Now, what can I do? Grace is too big a word. I'm still suffering the thinking mind. Then the much abused word comes in, surrender. I surrender this thinking mind at the feet of the source. I can't handle it. I tried, I would love to, but I am the problem. And so I offer that to God, that I can't deal with it, you deal with it. Now in meditation, let's say you start thinking about a movie which you saw last night on Netflix, right? And at some point, you stop, you realize I'm lost. The one thinking about that movie is not the one who's realized. That involvement has got cut off. Then the realization, I was involved. That cutting off is not the doing of the ego. So the ego cannot do the cutting off. By and by, when the ego with its sense of doership is diminished, dissolving, the thinking mind is becoming quieter and quieter and quieter, that is the gradual death of the ego. Sometimes it comes up based on past programming, genetics, could be. But even that is seen, my God, I didn't want it to be like this. I didn't want to react like this. Even this happened. I'm fed up. Even that is surrendered. Imagine, at least one is aware of it, aware of one's suffering. Most people aren't. So many people are too busy fighting and arguing and condemning others. To condemn someone else is to condemn God. And that includes yourself. To condemn and hate myself is to condemn and hate God. I'm not good enough. Why do I have these flaws? Why did God make me this way? Self-pity. God made you this way because God didn't make you that way. So simple.